Justin. If you're an artist, you're in the right place as a church. It's wonderful to have a church full of great artists like Chris and the band, and even Darlene and Terry Dingler, who built the set back here and so forth. So you're in the right place if you're an artist, and we need you because somehow the Western church has lost the arts in the church for the last 400 years, and it's time to get back to it because the church needs to be a place that isn't just following the arts, but is actually leading the arts. So there's my little plug for that. I got a few other plugs before I kind of really get going here. I don't know about you, but we're in the middle of Lent here, and we're talking about water and all of this, and I couldn't help but think about watching the 30-hour famine thing. My little girl's a fifth grader now, so she'll be participating in the 30-hour famine, and she's excited about it, and I just couldn't help but think of that documentary, God Grew Tired of Us, about the lost boys from the sub-Sahara Sudan. If you haven't seen that documentary, then you ought to watch it, about the little guys, 4, 5, 6 years old, who walked all those miles, and what they had to go through fleeing war and drinking out of muddy ruts and other things, unmentionable probably right now, desperate for water. And water seems so easy for us. And so, I don't know, it's just sort of a moment to bring that together and the things that are going on in the world. And one other thing, this is a piece of papyrus. And written on it in 3 languages is King of the Jews, in Latin and Greek and Hebrew. This is the sign above Jesus' head that the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, said, tear that down at the top of Jesus' cross. Because they didn't want that sign up there that Pontius Pilate had ordered put on the cross, said King of the Jews. And I bring this up because I think this is nothing more than a political statement. It was in competition and in rebellion against Caesar that this is what happens to people who think they're called king or Caesar. And so it's quite a political comment. We get in trouble around here for making political statements, but I think our Savior, Jesus Christ, has led the way. And so politics is always a part of things, and I'm going someplace with this. On the back of your announcement sheet, this Water for Lent thing is a little thing that we just kind of jumped into. I read about this last fall and thought somebody ought to do something about it, and lo and behold, people are. It is a thing about signing a petition against usury. Usury means exorbitant or actually any interest, really. And it's not on the legislation because the legislators don't want to touch it. But what it is taking payday loan interest rates from 445% down to a measly 36%. Any of you have a credit card in your wallet that's at 36%? Poor you. Well, at least it's not 445%. But anyway, this is a moment to do something, and it really doesn't require very much, except when you walk out of here today, sign the petition, okay? We are not the only ones doing this. We didn't start it. The other rest of the faith community and a couple other banks in town are working on this. About half the states in the United States have reduced the payday loan rates from hundreds and hundreds of percent, and Missouri's, going to try and join in on this thing too. So we'll see if it happens or not, but that's read about that, and you can see what you're doing. Okay, that's for the political comment. And you may still disagree with me on it, and I'm just fine arguing with it because I'm not backing down. Well, this morning I want to redescribe the Christian faith in terms of a journey, and I think we've all these years recently have heard Christianity described as a journey, but I want to take it one step further, and I want to re-describe the Christian journey really in terms of a pilgrimage, and I'm going to explain that here in just a moment. A journey that is really a pilgrimage, to be exact, because following Jesus is not just a get saved and manage your sin problem, and then sit around and wait to die, and in the meantime, keep yourself moral, so you don't, mess up. Although it wouldn't matter anyway because you're saved. We think there's a lot more to it. As a matter of fact, it's not much of a reach, and I think most of us would agree that there's got to be more to Christianity other than just getting rid of your sin problem through Jesus' cross and his blood. So we begin with this text from the Bible. We're dropping in the middle of a text, so I know you don't know the background on it and so forth, but I'll explain it as soon as we read it. Here we go. We begin with this text. Therefore, be careful to observe every command I'm giving you today, so you may have strength to go in and take over the land you're about to enter. If you obey, you will enjoy a long life in the land of the Lord swore to give to your ancestors and to you, their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 10, for the land you're about to enter and take over is not like the land of Egypt from which you came, where you planted your seed, made irrigation ditches with your foot as in a vegetable garden. Rather, the land you will soon take over is a land of hills and valleys with plenty of rain, a land that the Lord your God cares for. He watches over it through each season of the year. It comes from Deuteronomy 11. This is the voice of God speaking to the nation of Israel, the Hebrews. It's been 40 years since they walked out of Egypt as slaves through the Red Sea and wandered for 40 years on the Sinai Peninsula as exiles. 40 years. So the original generation that walked out of Egypt as slaves with Moses have now almost mostly all died off. And what is really being spoken to here, the group really being spoken to, is their children. Now, the children had the unique privilege of watching their parents misbehave badly for 40 years. It was a three-week walk from Egypt to Israel. But it took them 40 years because they couldn't get their act together and they didn't know how to behave. 430 years of slavery, everyone had pretty much forgotten about God from the original time when Abraham was in the land and then his son Joseph, and they all went down, you know, to do the Technicolor Dreamcoat thing down in Egypt. And so what happened then is they began to just be normal and live in Egypt until slavery got bad. And then they began to cry out, and Moses came, and you know the story here. Probably the most famous story in the Bible. It's the prevailing story in the Bible about the Exodus story. Okay? So these children that are now standing on the east bank of the Jordan River, looking across to the west bank of the Jordan River, are looking at the promised land originally from Abraham. Okay? And these children then really don't know anything about Egypt. They know about the desert, the Sinai Peninsula, from watching their parents misbehave. And they don't know anything about the promised land. They're at a defining moment. This defining moment where they're going to cross over the Jordan River. Now, using a garden metaphor, here's what God's telling the generation. He says this. Now look, in Egypt, your parents, when they wanted to grow food, it was very simple. The Nile River Valley, where they were, in the upper end of, or I guess the downstream end of the Nile River, flooded every year. Miles flooded, right, in the Nile Delta. All you had to do to grow your crops was simply knock out, plant your seed and stuff, knock out a little earthen dam or lift some sort of wooden gate or move a stone, and the water would come rushing in with the Nile flooded and irrigate all of your citrus trees and your date trees and your leeks and your potatoes and everything you wanted to grow. It was easy. It was fertile. You did not need God to grow food. All you needed was the Nile River. That's what God's trying to say to them. Life was predictable. And frankly, no one need rely upon God. You could grow your own food easily by just irrigating with the Nile waters. Now, in the wilderness, after they left Egypt and crossed over to the through the Red Sea, that original baptism, and wandered around for 40 years in the desert, the original exiles, that parent generation, they had a different idea. In Egypt, you didn't need God. But in the Sinai, Moses had led them out there, and now everyone's complaining about God. They had a different idea about God. God appears to be this sort of vending machine, this big Santa Claus vending machine that all you got to do is kick and scream and bang on and he'll give you whatever you want. You need water because there's no water in the desert, then you yell at God and he gives you water. You want this manna bread kind of stuff, he'll give it to you. You want quail, as God says, I'll give it to you till it comes out your nostrils. Okay, long story short, it is a very trashy time in the desert. Everyone's misbehaving. Moses, Mr. Calm and Collect himself, who threw a temper tantrum about every day, you know, comes down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments in stone written by the finger of God himself and is so irritated because the children, at least Aaron's description, this even gets trashier. He says, I don't know, we kind of all took our jewelry and threw it in the fire, and lo and behold, out popped a golden calf, so we decided to all worship it. Well, yeah, that's the natural thing to do. You know, Moses comes down, sees everything going on, this big, huge party going on, and he breaks the Ten Commandments and has to go off and chisel a new set himself out of his own anger. You see, out in the desert, you have a God that all you got to do is throw a temper tantrum at, and then you kind of get what you want. But you don't really care about God. Matter of fact, they complain to Moses all day long. Well, at least in Egypt, we didn't have this God who was going to starve us to death out here in the desert where we don't have any water or anything else. And then they get all dreamy about Egypt. We had potatoes and onions and leeks and all the meat and gold we could ever eat. We had anything we wanted back in Egypt. Sure, we were slaves, but I don't think it was that bad now I think back, because we had a house to live in and food. Maybe it's not so bad. We want to go home. And Moses is saying, that's not your home. The promised land's your home. Like, we don't know anything about the promised land. We know about Egypt, and we know about the stinking desert. That's the way it went. Moses is just simply trying to return the people to God. Rebuild a nation, or actually just begin a nation, even build it back to what it was supposed to be. And he says this there in verse 12 in the stuff we read. The land you're going to go to when you cross over the Jordan River, that land that you will soon take over is a land of hills and valleys. It's not like the Nile. It's a land of hills and valleys with plenty of rain. A land that the Lord your God cares for, and he watches over it through each season of the year. Nothing like Egypt. Nothing predictable. The land you're about to enter is nothing like the desert, the wasteland, the Sinai Peninsula. A vast, waterless, rocky place where you complain to God and you get what you want after he kind of gets tired of hearing your complaints. No, your homeland is the land that was promised to your ancestor Abraham. And it is rocky and hilly, and you're going to have to learn a whole new way of existence. You're going to have to pick up the rock, build terraces, you know, till the soil, plant your seed, and then you will do this most important step. You will wait. And you will wait for rain from heaven. And you will have to look to the sky and say, God, I need you. And be patient. Wait for rain from heaven. If you're around me for any length of period of time, you're going to hear me use this three soil metaphor over and over and over, because I think it explains the spiritual life, the spiritual journey. First, we all start out in Egypt. We're all secular people. We start off living life on our own. We don't need God. As a matter of fact, talk to most of your neighbors and friends and cohorts and so forth that are just good people, great people, moral people, and they... You know, if you tried to shove a Jesus down their throat, they'd be like, I don't need your Jesus or your God or your Christianity or your church or any of this stuff. I'm fine. We all live in Egypt. I do it myself. I kick out the dirt clod and the water flows in. I raise my own food. I got a paycheck. I got a family. I got a car. I'm good. So we all start out in Egypt. Now, if we're in Egypt, that also means we're slaves. It's a comfortable, beautiful slavery, though. Especially in America, where affluence and money and entertainment and success and busyness, all of this stuff tells you who you are and what journey you're on. It tells you what you're supposed to do. We easily buy into a dream of having more and more and becoming bigger and bigger. That's what we're all supposed to be doing, right? I remember watching one particular man years ago who had a wonderful family and lived on about 20 acres. Nice house, had a pool, great people, all this stuff's great. Living the American dream. Except for one thing. I never talked to the guy because he spent all of his days on a mower, on a riding lawnmower. That's what he did. He was mower man. I don't know what, if he didn't want to be around his wife or something, I don't know. But he spent all his days on a mower because he had 20 acres. He's got to mow this all day long. He just mows. Weed eat, mow. That's what he does. Come home, throw off the suit, get on the mower. I don't know what story that is, but I guess that means is that you say, well, look, kids, let me tell you what the point of living is. You come home from work, and you get on a riding lawnmower, and you don't stop until the job's done. And when you raise up your children, you teach them to get on a riding lawnmower, too. Got it? Okay, Dad, thanks. Is this living? It's a beautiful life, but it's a slavery. It's secular. It's pagan. It's like animals consuming, trying to collect enough nuts for the winter, and then living fat, dumb, and happy. That's the story that we're in. I'm a little cynical about it because I think it's kind of a lame story. That's it? Get your kid a garage door opener and a car and a big television, and that's it? Wake up in the morning, go to work, come home, get on the mower, eat some food, watch the blue tube, and then go to sleep and do it all again the next day. That's living. That's it. That's what story we're in. That's the big epic story. Oh, I know. I know. We're going to get everybody in the world to not be hungry, like the poor starving kids on the video. Everybody, we won't need any money anymore. We'll have world peace, no more wars or anything like that. And then we can all get on spaceships and zoom around the rest of the solar system and the galaxy and tell aliens to stop misbehaving, like Star Trek. That's what we're going to do. Okay. You know, if you're a thinking person, you wake up from the dream when you're in Egypt and you think, I'm in slavery. It's a really comfortable slavery. But I'm in slavery. Shouldn't there be more to life than just mowing and passing that on? What story am I in? And then every person on the planet begins to ask these deeper questions of like, is there a God? Am I meant for something else? Does my life have a purpose? Wake up and we ask ourselves, how in the world did I ever get to the situation that I'm in? Now, when you move out of Egypt, you move into the desert, right? And so now you've got a God, but it's not a very good relationship with God. It's a pretty trashy relationship with God. So now that you have a God, you have somebody actually to complain about because, you know, the original mower plan didn't quite work out. So you're like, God, how did I get $15,000 in debt for junk that's already sitting at the curb and I'm still paying for it? God, how come my kid, when he turned 17, went wild and off the deep end? I can't get him to hold down a job or anything like that. Now I'm supporting him when they're 23. You know, God, Why didn't you do something about my health? Because I'm about ready to retire, and now I got diabetes. That doesn't sound very fun. And you start kicking and shaking the vending machine God and the Santa Claus God saying, I want this and this and this and this and this, and you're wandering 40 years in the desert with your vending machine God. They're like, how come things didn't turn out? Why is my life such a mess, God? It's your fault. I want to go back to Egypt. I want to go back to the mindless mower and just ride until the sun sets. Because that looks a lot better than having you as my God. That is no fun. And about that point, just like in Deuteronomy, all of heaven falls silent. And God gives out a big oy vey. Yeah. All this sound familiar? Is this part of your journey? Any parts of it? You're in a relationship with God, but you're stuck between a happy, mindless existence that somehow sounds kind of nice, like in Egypt, and a God you don't know how to live with. You can't figure out why God doesn't intervene and solve all your problems and fix everything, and life turns out happy. You know it's all a part of the journey, don't you? It's part of the pilgrimage out of Egypt, through the desert, toward the promised land. It all belongs. It's all supposed to be there. It's not a mistake. It's the natural part of how life goes. At some defining moment, though, if you stick with the journey, you will stand at the east bank of the Jordan River ready to cross over to the West Bank and into the Promised Land, where you must learn in your relationship with God to wait for rain from heaven. And you must lose control. I was 16 when I felt like I was standing at the east bank of the Jordan River, a junior in high school. Now, I'd grown up as a good classic hypocrite. I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. Not that all Southern Baptists are hypocrites, don't get me wrong, don't put those two together, but I was, because I had this nice religious moral thing where I knew the King James Version of the Bible. I could quote it faster than about any other kid in the Sunday school thing. I knew all the religious things to do. I knew how to do the drill. I knew we were going to sing Just As I Am at the end of service, you know, 17 and a half times, waiting for poor old Ernie to come down and recommit his life again. You know, I knew that drill. But I had another part of my life that was drugs and guns and big rolls of cash. And we were posers running around, suburban kids, trying to pretend that we were thugs. And actually, we were thugs, you know, and people shooting and all this sort of thing. And we thought we were cool. I was stuck between the mindless pursuit of money and thrill and adrenaline and this moralist life where God was nothing but a big Santa Claus out to get me. But somewhere along there, I began to ask, is this it? That I'm going to end up in jail someday or shot or shooting somebody or something stupid like that? That's going to be it? And then I'm done? I sure didn't want to go to jail. And so one Christmas there, my junior year, I asked for a pocket New Testament from my religious mother and a guitar. And I got a $30 Sears guitar that came in a cardboard box and was made out of plywood. And I began banging on that guitar and thumbing through that New Testament, which I already knew. And about 3 weeks later, I fell on my knees one Monday night in my bedroom, and all I said was, God, help me. That was my moment of standing at the east bank of the Jordan River, ready to cross over. No return. I'm not going back to the desert or to Egypt. I really didn't know what to expect. I'd never really been there. But somehow I knew I was serious, and somehow God knew I was serious. There was no turning back. My relationship with God grew stronger and deeper. Now, that isn't without trials and hardships, because about 3 years after I'd done that, my dad had a stroke and was paralyzed on the left side of his body for the rest of his life, and most of his good mind was gone. That lasted for over 2 decades. My mother had diabetes and pretty bad diabetes, and she now had to take care of him, which pretty much, well, it killed her. The ups and the downs and the hardships and the waiting for rain from heaven, that's what the journey's like, everyone. It isn't that it all turns out great, like we think it's going to happen when we're in the desert. When you're in the Promised Land, you realize God is just with you during the hard times. He is present. I feel like I learned how to be a pilgrim. That's what we call it, a pilgrim. Now, I know when I say the word pilgrim, you're thinking of those original American pilgrims with the pointy hats and the buckle on the front and the blunderbuss gun and the turkeys and the pumpkins, you know, and call each other, you know, Elijah and Hezekiah or something like that. And then name their kids Cotton Mather. I hope you don't name your child Cotton. I mean, it's a nice word, but don't name your kid Cotton. Sorry, is there a Cotton in the room? I'm Cotton. Okay, I love it. It's great. But we have to become travelers. We have to become spiritual pilgrims. That's how you go through life. What does this look like? How do we take on the persona of pilgrim in this world? Well, and I don't know if you want to write this stuff down. It might keep your mind busy, but I'm going to give you 4 things that are features about a pilgrim. And here's the very first thing. Pilgrims travel light. I first saw this when I went to China, and I used to carry my big roller bag and all kinds of stuff. I mean, the biggest suitcase I could find. And then I got thrown, and they said, leave that in the hotel and just take whatever you can. And I found a sack or something in the hotel, and I piled in the back of an SUV for a three-day journey up into the mountains. And in the back, in that little cubbyhole in this cheap Chinese SUV, were two young men, Joshua and Jack. And all they had was a little bitty backpack for 3 days traveling. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how can you do that? And then I looked in the backpack as they took a couple of hours each and told us about how they came to faith in China, you know, where you're not allowed to do this sort of thing. And I looked in their backpack just by happenstance, and all I saw in there was a pair of underwear, a pair of socks, a big, huge horse-choking Bible, and a stack of worship CDs. I don't even know they had any way to play the CDs, but they had these worship CDs. And a big, huge Bible. I mean, a real bullet stopper, you know? And a pair of underwear and socks. That's all they needed. And I just felt so embarrassed. I thought, I brought too much. I don't need anything. I need to be more Chinese in this life. Here I am dragging, you know, in China, by the way, they don't have ramps. Okay, they just don't have ramps. So if you got a roller bag, you're carrying the whole thing the whole time anyway. So, you know, get over it. Pilgrims travel light. All you need is a pair of underwear and a pair of socks and some worship CDs and a big Bible. That's really about it. You know, as a pilgrim, you got to be able to pick up and go. Not because you're in a hurry. It's simply because you don't need anything like that because you're waiting on rain from heaven. Second thing, pilgrims go slow. Pilgrims go slow. That's the second thing about pilgrims. They go slow. Why do pilgrims go slow? Well, it's so they can develop an eyesight to be able to see God anywhere. Because if you're in a hurry, you can't see God. People in a hurry can't see God. Pilgrims begin to see the signs of God everywhere. They see the signs of God in their baby's face as it's sleeping. They don't think like, oh, that's cute. They think like, all of heaven opens up in that gentle breathing of that child. And they can't explain it with words. They see the signs of God when they're driving down the highway. The people around them in the countryside, it makes sense to them. They feel God's presence in the sunrise and in the sunset. They've seen the signs of God and take every thought captive because the slowness begins to make them a smart person. The raw intelligence of the person begins to go up because they begin to notice. They begin to develop a habit of noticing things about God. They begin to see that the world's an entire sanctuary, and it makes them smart. Do you know that busyness and being extremely busy keeps you from learning anything? It's more like you're an animal just running around. And I've said it many times, but you know what goes on out here, so now you're going to be scared to do this when you leave this room. But you walk out in the lobby, and this is the way it goes. Hey, Bob, how's it going? Yeah, pretty good, Bob. And, you know, and what happens is the Bobs talk, and they say, what have you been doing? Like, I've been busy. I've been real busy. Yeah, me too. I've been real busy too. What have you been busy doing? I've been busy. Yeah, okay. So then the conversation goes, I've been real busy. I've been real busy. And it's kind of a one-upmanship baby, a busy thing, you know, that's going on in the conversation. And then they say, okay, Bob, I'll see you next week. So we can talk about how busy we are. Because in America, if you're busy, you have a life. You are somebody. It tells you that you're not just some lame slacker person. And so we all go around and try and compete to see how busy we can be. And if you're not busy enough, then just get a little kid and start going to swim practice and horseback riding and all the other stuff we got to do. You'll be busy. Oh, yeah, and don't forget about the house falling down. That'll get you busy. So we go slow as pilgrims. And you begin to see everything as the signs of God. And the people in it become God things. And our judgment should begin to decrease. And we don't hold opinions of people like, I think they smell, or they're stupid, or they're not smart, or they're not like me, or their skin's a different color, or whatever else is going on. And we begin to hold people as precious gifts from God. We become like Jesus, who hanging on a cross says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing to Roman soldiers. They knew what they were doing. They're driving nails through a guy's feet. They didn't know what story they were in and why they were there. Third, pilgrims naturally learn to be silent. Pilgrims learn to be silent. They take walks along a wooded trail and they drive to work without the radio on. They learn to hold their tongue when talking with cohorts and family and friends. They learn the art of the small, quiet smile. You know what I mean? That when somebody else is talking, you don't step on what they're saying. You know how hard this is for me? You know how this our normal conversation goes, right? Somebody starts talking, and what we begin to do is think about, what am I going to say? Which is far more important than whatever they're talking about. And so you wait politely, if you're a polite person, for them to almost finish. And then you start saying something. One author called this stealing someone else's ego food, because it is another one-upmanship. It's like saying, so here's the way it goes. A friend of yours says, you go, what'd you do? Oh, we went out today and we got a big HD, you know, flat screen television. It is so cool. March Madness is going to be awesome. This is going to be awesome. You ought to see my television. It's really, really cool. And what you're thinking in your mind is like, oh, yeah? You haven't seen my refrigerator I bought this weekend. It's got adjustable, movable, spill-capturing shelves, crushed and cubed ice and water chilled, and a light bulb. Hold that up to your HD TV thing, right? And you steal the other person's ego food because they were so excited about their big HD television, you know? But you or we or me, okay, it's me, you know, you had to come up with something better. And now you deflate them. You ate their ego food that was going to build them up. Instead of just saying like, that sounds great. When can I come over and how hot's the chili? I'll watch the games with you on your new cool television from 20 feet away because it's so big. And just as an aside, this is where you should probably click off the recording. This is kind of politically incorrect, you know. But when I was in Boy Scouts, we had a little saying. It said, Indian, make small fire, sit close. White man, make big fire, sit far away. So you think about that next time you go buy a television, okay? Pilgrims learn to be silent. One spiritual writer said that silence makes us pilgrims. You want to learn to be a pilgrim? Stop talking. Start getting smart. Start noticing. Everything is divine. When we talk too much, it's like we leave the door open to the oven and it can't heat up. It's like you opened up the sauna or the steam bath door and all the steam goes out. How can we hear the patient, still voice, the small, still whisper of God when we can't even be quiet for a half hour or an hour? Finally, fourth, pilgrims are going someplace. They have a destination. They're not just wandering around aimlessly. Pilgrims have a destination. Listen to this beautiful passage from the Psalms that was part of our reflection. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, God, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. As they pass through the valley of Baca, that means weeping, they make it a place of springs. The autumn rains cover it with pools, and they go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion, that is Jerusalem. The valley of Baca translates, actually scholars really aren't totally sure, but it looks like it means tears. So imagine, here's the picture out of this psalm, and I think it's one of the most beautiful psalms in the Bible. Imagine this picture, and if you've been to the desert, it helps, but Missouri will probably do. You're walking through a dry stream bed, okay, and it's bedrock. It's not this muddy, gravelly stuff. It's carved out, and maybe the rocks overhang because, you know, it's really eaten down through the bedrock, and it rained a few days ago, but it's not raging now, and you can actually walk along the bedrock or the sandstone or the granite or whatever it is, and you're on a long walk for the day. Hike, and you're walking through the stream bed, and you come then, it's dry, you come then to these pockets back underneath a root ball or a overhang or a cleft, and there's a pool of this crystal clear water. Now, if you're a fisherman, you're like, any fish? Even if you don't have a fishing pole, you still do that. It's an automatic response. But if you were a pilgrim and you were traveling light with only a pair of socks and underwear, you need water. And this really works out better if you're in the desert as opposed to Missouri water. But you could drink the water. And so the imagery here is that you're walking from pool to pool, strength to strength, wandering on your journey. It takes about 3 days from somewhere in Israel, usually, to walk to Jerusalem. And you would walk and you would refresh yourself. Maybe you eat your snack or a light meal, or you just spend the night there next to a nice clear pool of water. You get the imagery? It's this beautiful moment of going from pool to pool, from strength to strength, until you arrive in the sanctuary of God. What about you these days, everyone? What about you? You feel like a solid, strong pilgrim in this life, like you're on a journey? You find yourself on this journey? You know, it takes some training, you know. It's going to take some discipline. No one drifts into a deeper relationship with God. But I tell you this. You have to wait on rain from heaven. Stop living in Egypt. Stop kicking against the goads out in the desert, against God. Wait for rain from heaven. Wait for rain from heaven. All of your desires will trick you all along. We are made in the image of our desires. Whatever we are craving, that's what we become. If it's anger, it's that. If it's money, it's that. If it's power, it's that. If it's God, it's that. You see, now, what I'm not trying to do is talk you into some sort of, you know, weird spiritual layered on thing as a substitute for your real life. What I'm trying to teach you to do is to learn your normal life with spiritual eyes. That's the goal of the Christian life. Not to leave the world, but to be in the world, just not of the world. Yes? Like Paul said. And our great temptation is to live our life, you know, and to take over God's job and be God. Isn't that the first temptation to Adam and Eve? God's holding out on you, Eve. I think you should eat from the fruit that you've been forbidden from, because then you'll be like God and know good from evil. And sure enough, Adam and Eve ate, disobeyed God, and they became like God. They were now saying, like, I know what's good and I know what's evil. I can call things good and I can call things evil. And that was God's job. They got exactly what they wanted, and it terrified them. And they felt so ashamed of the knowledge they now had that they began to cover up and hide their nakedness. And we have continued as a human race to hide our false self and our nakedness all along. And coming out of hiding is what pilgrims do. And it is a terrifying journey sometimes. This is the spiritual life. May this Lent make you into a pilgrim. May you do something to disrupt the status quo, the homeostasis. May you do something to rock the boat. Catherine Kraus, back at the prayer circle, developed an excellent thing. If you weren't tracking with it last week, she had you go back and pick up a rock that you carry with you. Mine got lost in the laundry here for a couple of days this week, but I found it. I found it. Yes, I got it back. And the idea is that you carry this until at least Good Friday, or carry it to Good Friday, or get rid of it before it and all of your sins. Anyway, she's got a brochure back there on a piece of paper that tells you how to do it. I'd encourage you to go back there and pick that up. There's also a Lenten guide that even has scriptures in it. Maybe your thing for this Lent would be like, I'm going to read the Gospel of Matthew. I'm going to read all of the New Testament. I'm going to read all 150 Psalms. I'm going to do something to disrupt my world. You know? And I'm going to get the stories of the Bible in my life so I can hear a different story of how I'm supposed to be living and where I'm supposed to be going. What story am I in? Who is Jesus? If you start reading the gospel, you'll probably should be ending up right about Easter, and you'll feel like, you know, you read the book and here comes the movie. You know what I mean? And that's fun. Okay? Well, why don't you stand and let us end with this Psalm 84, this 84th Psalm in the Bible where we talk about pilgrimage. And may this be you, and may this be your heart and your heart's desire, and we can read this all together and declare this together if you would just join me on this. And this will be our prayer and our blessing as we go out. Let us begin. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. As they pass through the valley of weeping, they make it a place of springs. The autumn rains also cover it with pools. They go from strength to strength till each appears before God. May it be so. Peace be to you. Go in peace.